Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by taking a look at federal historic preservation rules. And a great guest for you today, Sarah Bronin, is chair of the Federal Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Sarah also is an architect and a law professor at Cornell University, and her latest book is titled Key to the City: How Zoning Shapes Our World. It was published earlier this month by Norton & Company. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the Federal Historic Preservation Review process and maybe how it could be changed? Do the current regulations prevent renovating and reusing historic buildings? Maybe a balance could be struck? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sarah Bronin, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
In 2022, you were confirmed by the U.S. Senate to chair the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Tell us about the council and the influence it may or may not have over historic preservation regulations nationwide.
Well, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation is the independent federal historic preservation agency. And as its name suggests, it does do advising. So it does advise the president and Congress and other federal agencies and state and local governments on preservation policy. But it also oversees a regulatory process that requires the federal government to take into account, that's the phrase that's used, take into account the effects of their actions on historic properties. So what is a historic property for our purposes? It could be a building. It could be a structure like a bridge. It could be an archaeological resource. It could be a tribal cultural property or landscape. There's a lot of different ins and outs of our process, but maybe with that overview, we can continue the discussion.
Yeah, the council proposed an accelerated review process for historic preservation projects. Why is that needed?
So our review process was set out by the National Historic Preservation Act back in 1966, and again, has these steps that our agency has developed over time to ensure that historic properties are taken into account. In some cases, we found that the full process, it was called Section 106, the full Section 106 process is not needed because certain types of things that the federal government does won't have negative effects on historic properties. And so what we're trying to do is to use all the best practices that we and state historic preservation offices and tribal historic preservation offices have seen over time and say, look, we've observed these kinds of activities. We don't think they will have adverse effects, or we know that with certain strategies, we can minimize or eliminate their adverse effects. And we can move forward. And so what do we mean by activities? So the kinds of things that we're proposing include, for example, making it easier for historic buildings that receive federal funding to be converted to housing, that enable us to make historic buildings more energy efficient, and also to move forward certain transportation projects, including pedestrian projects like sidewalk repairs and crosswalk striping. So these are, it's a huge range of you know, federal government actions, but again, we're using what we've learned to say, hey, these don't need further review. And in fact, a lot of them make sure that buildings can be reused and historic districts can be accessed.
Yeah. I saw somewhere, I think 40% of the housing in the country is 50 years or older, or older, and a lot of it very much older.
Yes, I think that stat is right. And that's housing that exists today, that's not even including all of those older buildings that could be converted to housing. So you look at the pandemic and the federal government not using as much office space, so having some buildings that might be converted over to housing. You see in the private sector, the office sector downtown is flagging a bit. Those buildings might use federal funding to convert to housing. So the 40% of historic housing is one stat, but then you have all these other buildings that are not housing now but could be housing, and those could be put to good use.
So how do the current rules hinder this renovation and reuse of historic buildings for housing?
Well, we like to say from our agency's perspective that the full process certainly enables for agencies to thoroughly weigh the impact of their actions. And so our process right now in many cases requires sort of individualized decisions that go through the whole process. But what this program proposal is saying is, that process is great, and let's use what we've learned through that process to identify those things that don't need to go through the full process. So we try not to think of it in terms of, these our own process being a barrier, but we try to think of this proposal as being an opportunity for us as preservationists to identify for ourselves the things that we think will work for our historic properties.
Mm. Jeff in Superior, Wisconsin, has a comment, I believe. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Beautiful sunny day up here on the shores of Lake Superior. So I wanted to share a story of what happened here in Superior. We used to have a theater in East End that is now a hardware store. And what the owners have done is put up a movie screen so when you're shopping, you can be watching an old Western or something. And we had another situation where we had a curling club downtown Superior on Banks Avenue where the grocery store tore the curling club down, but they have photographs of the old curling club up on the walls in the grocery store. So what I'm trying to say is there's many ways to preserve the memory of a building or a site.
Yeah.
I love those examples. And that shows, in my opinion, how creative people who, the people who love historic buildings and historic places can be. I mean, I love to see historic places being repurposed, reused, modernized, to meet the hardware needs of the community in that case. And I love those examples. How fun. I'll have to visit sometime.
It's a beautiful place to visit. I could tell you that for sure, Sarah. I was thinking about an example of a housing situation, and this goes back quite a ways, but there was something called the Tenney Building, which was a medical facility in downtown Madison, and when they moved to a new facility, that building was turned into apartments. And providing, some decent housing right downtown in the city of Madison. And there are probably other people who've got examples like that as well.
So we are seeing increased interest in people living in historic downtowns, on small town main streets, because those places tend to be not only more vibrant, because there's always been a mix of uses in historic neighborhoods, but they also tend to be more beautiful, just more sort of appealing. And I love that we are seeing an increased interest in conversions of buildings for housing. And it's my view, and it's actually the view of our agency, that we've said there in our policy statement that we adopted last year, that's part of our advising role, by the way, in the policy statement that historic neighborhoods benefit from housing. The small town main streets benefit, downtowns benefit, even those places, where you might not expect benefit from more housing, more feet on the street, more people in the stores, more people in that hardware store watching those movies. So that's kind of our general view is like, let's go with housing. Let's do it. That's what we've always done as preservationists.
Michael in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your guests as well. I was recently on a trip to Portugal. I was lucky enough to go with my family. And in Porto, one of the historic buildings we were shown was, like, it was a beautiful building, and the entire exterior had been preserved and everything like that. But it was McDonald's. and, you know, like, as pretty a McDonald's as it might be, it feels a little bit cheap or chintzy to turn a historic building like that into a McDonald's to me.
Okay. Well, you want to comment on that, Sarah?
Gosh, I mean, so for me, it's hard to judge or to view negatively any entity that is investing in revitalizing a historic property. And I think part of what we see sometimes in preservation is this perception, real or perceived, that the preservationist might be a little snobby sometimes. My role as chair, my goal as a preservationist is to say, you know what, we've got to let buildings respond to the needs and of the community and to the market. So in that particular case, if you know, that particular business was the business that was willing to invest, that brought the building back to life, that brings people in to a community, you know, I mean, it's hard to you know, not look, what's the phrase, look that gift horse in the eye, or not look, you know, whatever the phrase is there. Yeah. It's hard to say, you know, that as a preservationist, you kind of object to the tenants. So I'm not going to say that. And so I'll say, you know, I look forward to seeing some photos of that, though, seeing how they integrated their branding, which, you know, is a big part of any franchise, with the historic fabric.
I've talked to many builders over the years. I have some friends or acquaintances, at least in Madison and other areas of Milwaukee, of Wisconsin as well. And they usually complain bitterly about the cost and the rules and the regulations that they have to go through. And then oftentimes just to get it turned down when they're trying to reuse an older, you know, an old building. And it sounds like you're trying to address that in some ways.
You know, there, a lot of what you're, you know, what you might be hearing is that there are different levels of review. So for us as a federal agency, our processes and our reviews really relate to federal agency action, not so much to maybe state and local commission reviews. We do hear a lot, though, from people who have undergone a local commission review process. So they go in front of their neighbors or members of their community who then say, you know, yes, you can do this, or you can do this with these conditions, or maybe sometimes they reject it. And that level of scrutiny is not something that most people are used to. When you buy into historic district, or when a historic district comes to you, let's say your community votes to adopt a historic district where you are, you do have that additional layer of process. So some people view it as a positive, so that, you know, people don't do something wild in their neighborhood. Others do view it as a restriction. I hope that, you know, as we're doing at the federal level, that state and local regulators, at whatever point they touch property owners and their historic properties, kind of continue to weigh the balance of the good of historic preservation, the beauty that it brings, with people's, you know, real needs on the ground, real needs to modernize their structures. And I do think that's an important balance.
Yeah. Sarah Bronin chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and we're talking with her about some changes proposed for historic reservation process policies with her. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1110. 1234, or you could email us, email address talk@WPR. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's an independent federal agency and oversees the nation's historic preservation policy. Great to have her with us. And certainly, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Somebody sent in a photo of the Portugal McDonald's restaurant. It says it is absolutely worth a visit, including the interior. That was, frankly, in need of restoration. And so it does look pretty nice in the photo that I have in front of me. Sarah, let's talk more. You're proposing, the council proposed an accelerated review process. What are the intricacies of that accelerated review process?
Well, for example, we say that when there's federal funding to convert a building from, let's say, an office building to housing, there's a lot of flexibility in the interior of the building where it doesn't impact the external facade for an entity to come in and reconfigure. Because we all know offices do not make for great apartments. So you got to reconfigure the walls on the inside. And right now our rules tend to require or trigger, you know, more of a review process as to what happens on the interior. Similarly, we have looked at exteriors, and some of the things in the draft include identifying which facades are not significant and allowing a lot of changes to happen to those, and maybe pursuing more gradual changes or changes after what we call a qualified professional has given the okay for things like a window replacement on a historically significant facade. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that, if you're talking about the details for our proposal, those are the kinds of things that are in it.
And, you know, a real goal is to make it easier to create more affordable housing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Affordable housing and you know, really all kinds of housing, because we've seen lots of studies that show that just the more housing you create across the board, the better. But, of course, we know the federal government is largely in the business of subsidizing and creating affordable housing. And that's what our process, you know, relates to, is really this federal actions and federal funding.
Yeah, and as I think as we, I don't know what the figures are, but we, across the country there, it seems to be a housing shortage, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we're seeing that in lots of places across the country, in communities, rural, suburban, urban alike.
And you talk about the fact that this process or the proposal would create more energy efficient and climate resilient buildings if this preservation process was more streamlined. Why is that?
So, you know, when we look at what's been happening during this administration, the Biden administration, we've seen a huge investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy. And every dollar that is going out under these programs that Congress and the president have created, the bipartisan infrastructure law and so on, that will all go through our Section 106 process. So what we've said as a body, we last year adopted a policy statement, a very official sounding name, on climate change and historic preservation. And what we said in that document was we need to make it easier for historic buildings, whether they're housing or not, to be made more energy efficient and to integrate renewable energy. So if we're kind of taking that as a starting point, then we have to say to ourselves, all right, how is our regulatory process going to change to actually make that happen? And I think, you know, what we're proposing, so we do have a part of that, the program comment on housing. We also have a part on just buildings generally, so whether they're federally owned or they're federally funded or permitted, we, you know, have seen that there's a big need for us to streamline. So is weather stripping and caulking, is that a valid action? Well, we said in the program comment, for any building, that's go forward. You know, go forth and prosper, federal agencies. Go and insulate all you want. You know, from a weather stripping perspective, we do talk about insulation. We talk about low flow water filter, conservation measures. We talk about energy efficient windows and other types of improvements like that. That where our process would be clarified for all buildings, not just housing.
How difficult is it now to upgrade electrical systems and upgrade the energy efficiency of historic buildings?
You know, I think it's so. So in general, we've seen. Let's just stepping really, you know, back. Historic buildings, especially those 50, 60 years and older, tend to be pretty energy efficient. Because they have thicker walls than modern buildings, because they have, you know, the kinds of windows that were built to last. We do see, however, the need for those buildings to become more energy efficient using modern technologies and to diversify their energy sources, including things like adding solar panels. So building decarbonization, that's kind of maybe a catchphrase that some of you have heard of, taking the carbon intensity in terms of building operations out of building operations, reducing the energy that it costs to that it takes to operate a building, and then actually, you know, in the case of solar panels, enabling a building to actually positively contribute back to the grid.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as on a personal note, the house I live in now, I bought it was a 1906 home, and I did all of the upgrades all of the tightening and all interior. The exterior looks just like it always did, but the interior is now an Energy Star home, I guess you could call it. That's in fact what it's designated at. So it can be done, and in the end, I've been able to save, and I think this is on my little personal level here. I've been able to save some things, but. If more of that could be done across the nation, I think we'd all be better off.
Absolutely. In fact, we refer to energy efficient and Energy Star appliances in the draft as well, because we know that those energy efficient appliances and also electric appliances is a big priority across all building types, including housing.
Jennifer in De Pere called to ask, and here, and we just talked about this, is there flexibility in federal historic preservation to allow for adding solar panels or solar shingles to a historic building? She was told they couldn't do that on their old home in a historic district. And Jennifer's wondering, is there a push for flexibility? It sounds like there is.
You know, our proposal would add flexibility in situations where maybe local historic commissions haven't allowed as of yet. So we may be moving forward in a way that, you know, will encourage some state and local folks who are reviewing these, you know, similar projects to also to loosen or to make more flexible their standards. So I wrote, as chair of the advisory council, a long report. It's actually 600 pages if you count the appendices, to my fellow members about federal historic preservation standards and the need for them to become more flexible. Interestingly, our agency doesn't actually establish these federal standards. It's the Department of the Interior. And so they are one of our 24 council members. So we are an independent agency, but we're also a council. We have about 10 federal agencies on our council, and we've encouraged the Department of the Interior to really take to heart some of the suggestions that we got when we were evaluating their standards from the field. And, you know, like your caller, it's sometimes ambiguous or sometimes a little tough to see how the field might continue to evolve in a consistent way in a way that honors that flexibility that preservationists are known for. I mean, you go back to some of the examples your earlier caller said, we're known for being creative and flexible. So let's embrace that. That's really my approach.
Kevin in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
So my situation is kind of a funny one. This was like maybe 20 years ago, but a person in my neighborhood, and it was a historical district, bought a building, and it was previously for years a taxidermy shop.
Okay.
And he opened a pizza restaurant. Our city wouldn't let him take the sign down. For 2 years. So, you know, the historical thing can go a little bit extreme sometimes.
And if you're on Twitter or LinkedIn, tag me at Sarah Bronin, S-A-R-A-B-R-O-N-I-N. I got to see a picture of that one. That one sounds amazing.
Kevin, thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. What questions or comments or maybe an experience to share do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Ron in La Crosse will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to find out if there's any effort to collectivize the egress. In other words, these small buildings oftentimes don't have adequate second exits and elevators, which limits the upper floors in many downtowns like La Crosse and other small towns in Wisconsin to not be able to afford those improvements. That's a big hurdle, maybe $250,000 or more. Is there any effort to collectivize those with these smaller buildings to share where it seems like it could work, that cost with the government to, in effect, we subsidize roads, obviously, and this is a vertical access way, if you will. So kind of like vertical roads, in effect, in these smaller buildings.
Yeah. Ron, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Sarah?
You know, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think a lot of what you know, your callers are talking about it sometimes zoning with the taxidermy pizza shop, and in this case, building codes and the need to ensure that buildings are accessible. A lot of our work at the agency focuses on the regulatory side, so the permitting process and how if an elevator is proposed, it can be nicely integrated into the historic building. On the other hand, you know, you raise a good point about government's role in subsidizing and supporting accessibility improvements in historic properties. Now, I don't know of an elevator fund for private buildings that's, you know, very specific to historic buildings, but I do agree with you that we invest an awful lot of money on some things, and I would include highways to your point in that. A group, billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars. And if a drop in that, you know, drop in the bucket could do a huge amount for making our historic buildings more accessible. I'll just note that on the road side, especially in the federal interstate highway side, Congress has actually exempted interstate highways from our process. So when you're thinking about priorities, when you're thinking about sort of congressional, this was years ago, congressional priorities and kind of how we manage that process, you know, you do wonder, how did that come about? Because we know that highways and highway expansion definitely has a lot of impact on historic places and not necessarily good ones.
Yeah. I interviewed an engineer who had written a book on that process about how engineers actually create more problems sometimes because of the way they go about setting up roads and the kinds of problems that happen, and avoid proposals that would be more people friendly. And I think in your proposal, it could result in more bicycle lanes, more sidewalks, and more public transport or transit projects. Is that correct? And talk about that.
Sure. And that's maybe the flip there, the parallel to, you know, the question of how buildings can become more accessible. So, you know, the elevators and the ramps and those kinds of things. This is how communities and historic districts can become more accessible by allowing people to arrive at them using a lot of different methods. So you've already heard we have a policy preference embedded in laws at every level for roads. That's just the, how things have evolved. And so if we want to promote other kinds of ways of getting around, I guess buses use roads, so let's put that on there, but bike lanes, better sidewalks, better transit, you know, bus stop facilities and so on, we have to write that into our policies. So we really do need to, I think, put the thumb on the scales for the kinds of transportation alternatives that we do address in the program comment. So our agency has proposed, put the draft out there for this document that enables any agency that's putting in a sidewalk or that's maybe striping a road. And that can happen not just by departments of transportation or the Federal Department of Transportation, but it can also happen with other entities like military facilities, which have roads that the military manages, or large public housing complexes and so on. So it's not just the DOTs that that deal in these kinds of actions. So we're hoping, you know, that helps, again, put the thumb on the scales to different types of transportation alternatives.
Yeah. And you're working, are you working with Indian tribes to make sure this proposal addresses their concerns about preserving historic buildings and landmarks?
Yes, I think, you know, a lot of what, so we did finish our first, our round of tribal consultation and public comment. We always hear from Indigenous tribes, Native Hawaiian organizations, and other Indigenous peoples about the need to be very cautious about activities that would disturb ground, for example, in particular, as opposed to necessarily significant concerns about historic buildings. And, you know, we're still going through our comments, but we view those very, very carefully. In a broader sense, we have seen significant engagement with various members of Indian tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations. And just Monday, I announced that our agency had adopted what I hope is a groundbreaking policy that recognizes Indigenous knowledge of Native Hawaiian organizations. And it says that in our Section 106 process, when a Native Hawaiian organization is doing a federally funded or permitted or supported activity that involves their Indigenous knowledge, involves their traditional sites and practices, that they and not the federal government are the experts. And so, you know, we're trying to get the federal government out of the process of getting involved with interpretations of Indigenous knowledge. And that was a first step. So, you know, we continue to cultivate our relationship with Indian tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations, and we do it carefully and in consultation.
Thinking about money as we go along, is there a proposal to make more money available to communities to perhaps break down barriers to housing?
Meaning?
I mean, is there federal money? I mean, is there going to be federal money tied to or become a part of the proposals that you have forwarded?
Yes, I see. So there is already a significant amount of funding that is devoted to the activities that we have identified. Our agency doesn't provide the funding, but if you look at the $10 billion in the DOT budget for safer streets, multimodal transportation, and the billions that DOT is spending on public transit. If you look at the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, you know, and associated in related funds, $27 billion, I think the number is. If you look at the investments that HUD makes simply in maintaining their existing housing stock, you know, this is something that, you know, also runs in the billions, and a lot of that is devoted to properties that are designated historic just by virtue, you know, of the significance of public housing, but also their age. And that's not to mention all of the federal dollars that are going through community block grants, community development block grants, through state and local governments to housing and to energy efficiency and other and transportation upgrades. So, you know, my perspective is we've seen that these funding for these activities has significantly ramped up, which means that we're seeing a significant number of new activities that are kind of running down the pipeline and will have to undergo a review process. So we're trying to get ahead of that a bit and to say, as this additional funding comes in, you know, we need to review projects smarter and more efficiently. Maybe our process will trigger additional funding that's devoted specifically to historic buildings. That would be a great outcome.
Yeah, it would indeed. I think one of the other complaints, or I mean, I don't know if it's a complaint is the right word, or comment on the whole process when it comes to working on historic preservation and getting those buildings up to code and the work that gets done is the interest rates that have vacillated quite a bit over the years and over the last couple of years in particular, and how that affected the whole process of housing, and for example. And so some interest rate stability, I think, would be important for a lot of people who are involved in this.
You know, yeah, I mean, I can't comment so much on the financial markets and on interest
sure.
rates, but it's all related. So we have to make improvements in lots of different areas, and we're doing our little part at the agency.
Our guest today, Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's a great conversation I'm having with her. Excuse me. And I hope you'll join in. Questions for her, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today on the show, we'll learn from state and federal ecologists about the effects of neonicotinoid pesticides on the environment. Right now, we're visiting with Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's an independent federal agency. It oversees the nation's historic preservation policy. And great to have Sarah Bronin with us. She's an architect and law professor at Cornell University. Her latest book is Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World, just published last month by Norton & Company. So great to have her with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. David emailed to say that once he once observed a conflict between federal agency representatives evaluating work on a historic lighthouse on how to make it accessible for persons with disabilities. The accommodation did not mesh with the perspective of the preservationist. David says he doesn't know how that issue was resolved, but what are your thoughts about the issue, accessibility for wheelchairs, et cetera?
Well, we've said as an agency in our program comments and our policy statements that accessibility is a high priority, and really in our policy statements, I should say, that the Americans with Disabilities Act is sometimes seen as a requirement that could conflict with historic preservation. But in my view, I'm a licensed architect. I don't think, you know, that kind of perspective, I think, is limiting in terms of its viewpoint, because a good architect, a good project manager can make accessibility work in almost every circumstance. And I'm not talking about an 18th century house museum, right? You're not going to put stick an elevator on most of those, right, on the outside or something like that. So those might have to be those those types of properties that rely on different kinds of accessibility through videos and something else. But for the most part, historic buildings can and should be made accessible, especially, I mean, the public buildings that are subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act, of course, in particular.
Oh, if at all, does your agency work with state or local agencies like, you know, Wisconsin State Historic Preservation Office or the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation?
Sure. Our process, our normal process, our Section 106 process, does provide a role for state historic preservation officers as offices or officers, as well as local governments. And so, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. I appointed as chair two organizations, the National Alliance of Preservation Commissions and the National Preservation Partners Network, as observers to the ACHP. So I can appoint up to five myself, and I've appointed five actually as of last week. I added a fifth one, the Permitting Council. But I have appointed those bodies because they bring that state and local expertise to our discussions, and I want them at the table. So there's a role in the regulatory process. There's a role through our membership and in the advising process. I myself served as chair of a statewide preservation organization, Preservation Connecticut, and I also served on my local historic district commission in the city of Hartford, which is Connecticut's capital city. So I, again, myself have had experience at both the local and state levels before getting over here to Washington, D.C., and I greatly, greatly value it in our agency as a whole. Values the input of state and local partners.
Yeah. The election's coming up soon. And I'm wondering, do you anticipate support for the council's proposal regardless of who wins the election?
Historic preservation tends to be a bipartisan issue. People from all sides of the political spectrum are all parts of the political spectrum, I guess, I think recognize the value of historic places. So I think the council will continue to move forward in it across anything that comes before us for a better, more effective approach to our processes where we think it aligns with preservation values because it, you know, actually in the case, again, for this particular proposal, hopefully it will enable the continued use of historic buildings and the enjoyment of historic districts and sites. And that, again, that's a pro-preservation outcome.
Yeah, it is indeed. And someone else is wondering, do you have a way for people to look at the proposal?
Sure. It's available on our website, achp.gov. You could also follow the USACHP on social media, and we'd love to connect. And I'm personally at Sarah Bronin on social media or LinkedIn. So I definitely talk a lot about this proposal and everything that we're doing. So feel free to find me or at Chair Bronin on Twitter.
And you took leave from your tenured position as a tenured faculty member. At Wisconsin, I can understand that. But this must have been really important for you to take this position, and maybe why.
I'm not hearing any audio.
Oh,
I'm not sure.
Are you hearing me now?
Yes, I heard you now. The last thing I heard from you is you said that, you know, I took a leave from Cornell University, and that is absolutely correct. They were very gracious to give me a two-year leave to pursue this position here in D.C.
It was pretty cool. And you're obviously, as I mentioned, you're an architect and an author, and you have a new book published earlier this month, Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. How central to city government are zoning rules? Pretty central, I would think.
Absolutely. So, you know, just to put on my non-ACHP hat here and say that, you know, zoning is the thing that dictates almost everything that gets built in this country. So virtually every city in the country, other than my hometown, believe it or not, of Houston, has zoning. And so when you look at look around you, almost anywhere you are, you can see how communities have developed. And if you have the patience to read a 150-page zoning code, or in some cases, City of Boston, almost 3,800-page zoning code, you can really match the rules on the page to what you see around you. And that's really what Key to the City is about. It's trying to educate people on what zoning is and why we should take an interest in it.
And how can zoning improve a community?
Well, zoning can be used to actually create very positive outcomes in terms of better housing, in terms of more equitable and connected places, in terms of sustainability, things like tree canopy coverage and eliminating minimum parking requirements have win-wins for the individual property owner, for the neighborhood, the community as a whole.
And here you are. You're a native of Houston, Texas, which I think is the only major city without zoning.
Absolutely. Yep, it is. The only one that we found so far. Now, that said, there are a lot of smaller jurisdictions, a lot of counties and small towns that don't have zoning, but, you know, they're a lot of them tend to be pretty small in population. That's why I say the only large city without zoning.
I just wondered how that has affected Houston. I imagine in many, many ways.
Largely for the worse, and I talk about that in the book. In fact, I start chapter one of the book in Houston, where I grew, in the block where I grew up. And because there's no zoning right across from the block, there's a gas station, a self-storage facility, a strip mall, a nightclub. You know, that's not exactly a great place for a kid to grow up.
Jake and Madison may have one final question here. Jake, hi.
Hi, great show. I'd love your comments on, I live on Williamson Street in Madison, and for the past 20 years, we're really not allowed to do any upgrades for windows and things like that on our houses. But in a short amount of time, in a couple of years, a lot of these houses are just going to be demolished and five-story condos are going to be put up. And just wanted to get your comment on kind of that. I don't think that makes a lot of sense for over-regulating some areas.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's exactly why I am really pushing for this program comment, this proposal. Because if we cannot modernize our historic buildings, they will become obsolete. They will, you know, be put on the chopping block. And that's just not something that I, as a preservationist, want to see. It's not something that any preservationist should want. So we have to, like, just really reverse course in a lot of ways on the flexibility that we provide. You know, get out of that mindset of, oh, if anything changes, that's a defeat. Actually, if things change, that's a victory. That means people are investing in their buildings. And I'm not saying, you know, let's, you know, do something crazy. But I think the kinds of changes that we're proposing in the program comment will really go a long way to helping communities thrive and renew their investment in historic buildings in particular.
Jake, thank you very much. And Sarah, thank you very much for taking an hour of your time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I know our listeners have as well. And the email address of the council is up now as a link on our program notes for today at the Larry Mueller Show. And again, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. Talk soon.
Sarah Bronin chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, independent federal agency, and overseeing the nation's historic preservation policy. And we'll have a link to the policy itself as well on the Larry Mueller Show website. So look to that for more information. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the effects of neonicotinoids on our environment with our two guests for you. I'm Larry Mueller.